today on Against the Grain.
The idealization of ancient Greece and Rome is so strongly imposed by both our educational system and the classicism of our nation that there's a great tendency to say, oh, ancient slavery, that's a feature of the time. Exclusion of women from civic rights, that's a feature of the time. Let's look at all these other amazing things they did. And really, those things are all bound up together, and the white nationalists know that.
Ancient Greece and Rome are venerated throughout our society, including on the far right. Is this a misappropriation or misuse of the ideals of Greco-Roman antiquity? Classical scholar Curtis Dozier argues that when white nationalists appeal to ancient thinkers to justify their reactionary ideas, there's surprisingly much to draw from. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Greco-Roman antiquity represents the pinnacle of American civilization for many. Its iconography and purported values permeate American society, providing the visual language of officialdom. And as Curtis Dozier shows in a new book, the far right legitimates itself by dressing up in the pedigree of the Greco-Roman past. That book is The White Pedestal, How White Nationalists Use Ancient Greece and Rome to Justify Hate. Curtis Dozier is Associate Professor of Greek and Roman Studies at Vassar College and the director of their website Pharos, which documents right-wing groups' use of Greco-Roman antiquity. How widespread would you say, Curtis, is the appropriation of ancient Greek or Roman imagery by white nationalists today?
I think it's pretty widespread. The resurgence of white nationalist activism in this country that we've seen over the last really couple decades has changed its tactics in the way it promotes its ideas. This is influenced by some of the new right movements in Europe, which came into being in the aftermath of the Second World War, when in many European countries, fascist symbols and political organizing were actually banned and criminalized. And so new methods for promoting neo-fascist ideology needed to be developed. And that has made its way to the United States. And one of the ways that these groups and activists promote their ideas is by linking them to periods of history or forms of knowledge that are already respected or admired or taken seriously by the general public. And so I think the activists are always on the lookout for something they can link their ideas to make them seem more respectable, seem desirable, maybe even seem inevitable. And Greco-Roman antiquity, as I argue in the book, provides a very fruitful rhetorical ground for these links. And so I think as this technique for, or this program for promoting white nationalist ideas took hold in this country, I think we do see more and more use of the Greco-Roman world by these activists because it provides the kind of respectability that they seek to harness in spreading their ideology.
Well, as you're just alluding to, this is not just the far right. Ancient Greece in particular is seen as the pinnacle of Western civilization. In this society, there's, you know, a very long history of states, including the U.S. state, kind of attaching itself and its sense of being part of this long trajectory and pedigree that dates back to antiquity. So for many people, particularly ancient Greece, sort of represents democracy and represents all that's meant to be good in our society. When white nationalists appropriate ancient Greece and ancient Rome to shroud themselves with its pedigree, is that a misappropriation of antiquity, or is it more complicated as you're suggesting?
It's much more complicated, but I want to admit that when I first started doing this research, I thought the white nationalist use of this history was a misappropriation. I thought it was a distortion. I thought they were inventing history. And on some level, I thought, what could these people even really know about history? Because I think both as an American surrounded by classical architecture in our nation's capital and in all the most prominent buildings in our cities, and then also as a classical scholar, where I think to be a classical scholar, you have to have a certain amount of admiration, or certainly that's baked into a lot of the training I received for the ancient world. I think I shared the common view that you've just articulated, that the ancient world, especially ancient Greece, represents a sophisticated, enlightened, high society that's worth taking seriously. And that view, which is very widespread in this country and in many places in the world, ignores or sanitizes or leaves out just how much of ancient political thought, of ancient philosophical thought, and of ancient social and political practices is actually very congenial to white nationalist interpretation. In some cases, ancient thinkers have articulated ideas that are identical to ideas that contemporary white nationalists want to promote. So the kind of dominant or predominant admiration for the ancient world masks, distracts us away from many of the ways that the ancient material suits white nationalist politics. And that's what I discovered the more I worked on this material, is that I came to it thinking that my job as a scholar was to show that white nationalist activists didn't know anything about history, were misinterpreting it, were misrepresenting it, were abusing it, is another word that gets used a lot. And you do find a lot of examples of that. It's easy to find people who, you know, on social media or in Reddit threads or, you know, in the corners of the internet who are making up things about the ancient world or grossly misrepresenting it. But the more I delved into those communities and the publications that inform them, I found a group of people who surprised me for the sophistication and depth of their understanding of the ancient world. And that's who I really focused on in the book, because they're the ones who I think pose the greatest challenge to our understanding of the ancient world and to reflecting on the way we value the ancient world and why it's so prominent in our dominant culture, because they know a ton about ancient history. I sometimes think they see the ancient world with clearer eyes than even some professional scholars, because they see and recognize and know about all the authentic ancient material that supports white nationalist politics very well.
Well, before we get into that, you know, one tussle, controversy that burst out into the public a number of decades ago in the late 1980s around antiquity, especially ancient Greece and the present, was occasioned by the publication of Martin Bernal's book, Black Athena, which argued that historians in the modern era had traced a racial through line from ancient Greece to their time, seeing the ancient Greeks as white Europeans. Can you tell us what that debate was about?
Martin Bernal published a three-volume work called Black Athena, The Afro-Asiatic Roots of Classical Civilization. You summarized part of his work. Part of his work was about the history of the ways that interpreters of the ancient world, starting in the 17th and 18th century, created a racial link between the ancient Greeks and Romans and the modern Europeans, who the emerging race pseudoscience of that time racialized as white. That's a big part of the first volume. Another part of his book was arguing that in antiquity, the ancient Greeks and Romans were very happy to see their civilization as related to, and in some respects even derivative from, African and Asiatic civilizations. And by African, he especially meant Egypt. So part of the book was an accusation against historians of whitewashing and racializing ancient history and kind of suppressing all of these interconnections and dependencies between the ancient Greco-Roman world and the Near East and North Africa. And this was taking place in a time of wider controversy in this country about sort of the erasure of African history and thought. And this was being driven by activism in English departments, in sort of the emergent field of Black studies in this country. And all of a sudden, classical scholars who are used to occupying both an isolated and privileged position within the academy found themselves in the middle of this larger dispute around the kind of white supremacist biases of history and of literary canon formation and all those things. And I think many classical scholars reacted defensively to that. I think the defensiveness was against the accusation of racializing and whitewashing, but it was given fuel by the flawed nature of many of Bernal's etymological arguments, which could be empirically demonstrated, at least on the basis of state-of-the-art linguistic science, to be incorrect. And so some of his claims about the etymological relationships between certain names of deities and in the Greco-Roman pantheon and Afro-Asiatic deities and so on could be shown to be false. And so the defensive reaction latched onto that and sort of rejected everything he was arguing. Even though his history of the white supremacist biases in the early modern and 18th and 19th and even into the 20th century account of the history of Greco-Roman civilization, you might pick around the edges, but they were pretty accurate and based on a pretty careful reading of a lot of historians writing in those periods. And so that knowledge and that approach to understanding the ancient world and the sort of racism that underpinned a lot of the interpretation of the ancient world in the 17th, 18th, 19th century got thrown out and mocked, at least in classical studies circles, along with the other aspects of his argument. Classical studies defended itself against these accusations that were true and sort of set back the study of this material for many decades, sort of put it off limits for the field for many decades, even as many, many other fields were spent those years coming to terms with the racist histories of their disciplines.
Given that history, what was obscured in the backlash? What was obscured about both the operation of something that we might think around as race, obviously a very modern notion in terms of thinking about Greco-Roman antiquity, but also as you're arguing that at the same time, even if we recognize that the Greeks, the Romans, thought very differently about, say, skin color and so on, than people in the modern era, modern racism, that there still was fertile material in those cultures that white nationalists today could appropriate and appropriate without doing great ideological damage to the sources they were appropriating.
Long before Bernal, there was scholarship demonstrating that the ancient Greeks and Romans did not think about racial identities in the way that modern race pseudoscience does. They did not have a category of whiteness that corresponds to the modern category of whiteness that assumes that the genetics that produce that color skin and hair and eyes predict other genetics that produce superior creativity, intelligence, morality, and so on. That's sort of the fundamental lie of modern and early modern race pseudoscience, is that the genetics that produce skin color predict the genetics that produce other qualities on a group level. And what scholarship before Bernal had already demonstrated was that the ancient Greeks and Romans did not have those assumptions about appearances. And so amid the backlash against Bernal, that research was marshaled and took on a great prominence in the public imagination as a way of defending the ancient Greeks and Romans against this accusation of racism, which Bernal hadn't really made. He had made it about the interpretation of the history of the Greeks and Romans. But in that period, this research became very well known and sort of spread beyond classical studies widely. And so that created a kind of scholarly orthodoxy that the ancient world and the pre-modern world in general did not have. In the most extreme case, it made the claim that they did not have a concept of race, and that usually brought with it the assumption that they did not have racism in the sense that we mean it. And that actually is an important historical finding, because so many white supremacist arguments about the superiority of white people and the inferiority of other people depend on claiming that these are biological realities that are true in all times and all places. And if you can show that, in fact, no, these ideas about human difference are historically contingent, that they change and shift depending on the needs of the dominant culture, depending on who the dominant culture wants to exploit and vilify and subjugate, if you can show that ideas of race and human difference change with those, you can undermine the white supremacist claim that this is a genetic natural reality in all times and all places. So that's an important claim to make. But what that does not mean, or what got obscured, is the way there's all kinds of forms of hatred connected to violence and exploitation in antiquity that follow the same logic as the modern white supremacist ideas of whiteness and blackness and everything in between. And there's a whole group of classical scholars. My work is kind of adjacent to theirs, but there's a whole group of classical scholars, true historians of race, who are beginning to undo that orthodoxy and to show that it's actually very useful to talk about the idea of race and racism in antiquity, not that it follows the same principles as modern racism, but that there are sort of essentializing assumptions about groups of people that justify violence, exploitation, and oppression in a parallel way to the way that early modern anti-blackness justifies the enslavement of Africans and the extermination of indigenous peoples. And that it's not only historically true to recognize that that existed in antiquity, but that it is productive to recognize it, and then you realize new things. You understand antiquity better once you realize that. And just to come back around then to the subject of my book, this is one of the ways that I think that the white nationalist activists that I study see the ancient world more clearly than many professional scholars, because they, through this whole period, never had any doubt that the ancient Greeks and Romans engaged in articulated attitudes about human difference and toward outsiders and foreigners that could productively be described as race and racism, because they think racism is something we should be practicing. They think white supremacy is something that defines the most prosperous and desirable societies in human history. And so they look at ancient sources, which I discuss in my book, and recognize the racial logics at work that whole generations of scholars were taught to explain away and ignore and suppress in a way. And then the white nationalist activists can use those ancient statements of the nature of human difference to argue that their white supremacist politics in the contemporary world have strong historical analogies in these admired ancient societies.
Classical scholar Curtis Dozier is my guest. He's the author of The White Pedestal, How White Nationalists Use Ancient Greece and Rome to Justify Hate. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain. Then, so you're just arguing that white nationalists in some ways have been more attentive, in a sense better scholars, of ancient Greco-Roman societies than a lot of classicists have been. And I wonder if you could talk about the hierarchies of those societies, much lionized in our times, and the thinkers who we tend to think of in very benign ways who justified such hierarchies, such as Plato.
Plato is a very fruitful author for white nationalist thinkers. In the popular imagination, Plato is considered one of the greatest thinkers in the history of humanity. Almost all introductory philosophy courses will either begin with or very early on have devote significant time to Plato. Alfred North Whitehead, who, you know, is a major 20th century philosopher, said that the safest general characterization of the European philosophical tradition is that it consists of a series of footnotes to Plato. Plato is held up as a kind of archetype of the human genius. So he's a very admired figure. The white nationalists that I write about know that a lot of the ideas that characters in Platonic dialogues articulate are very similar to ideas that they themselves would like to see implemented in contemporary societies. In The Republic, Plato's probably most famous dialogue, best known for the Allegory of the Cave, so-called, but a long work with many important passages. In The Republic, for example, Socrates, the character in the dialogue, says that in this ideal city that they're designing, deformed children should be taken away and put in a dark place where no one will ever see them again. He says that in the ideal state, reproduction should be controlled so that only the best people can reproduce with each other to try to produce the best kinds of citizens. So there's this strain of eugenic thought in Plato that corresponds very closely to some ideas that different fascist regimes have implemented and that white nationalist intellectuals believe are worth considering in the contemporary world. And they get this respectability when they can be taken from Plato and other ancient authors. To return to your point about ideas of ancient race, there's a passage in Plato's Laws where one of the characters, referring to the Persian Wars, when a giant army from Persia invaded Greece and was defeated by this sort of ragtag band of Greek citizens from the various city-states. Referring to the Persian Wars, in the aftermath of the Persian Wars, one of the characters in the Laws says that if the Persians had been victorious in the Persian Wars, we would have had a complete mixture of the races, Greek and barbarians. And so the white nationalists point to that passage to show that the Greeks understood that maintaining the racial purity of a community is essential to its survival and its strength. Now, you can challenge that interpretation of that passage by pointing out that the word that appears in that translation, we would have a complete mixture of the races, is a word that refers to ancestry and sort of family lineage. We would have a complete mixture of ancestries. If you translate it that way, it doesn't have the same kind of force that it has when the white nationalists quote it with the word race. But that translation that they quote is not one that they made up. It's one they've taken out of a completely mainstream popular translation published by Penguin. And in fact, if you look at the major lexica for translating ancient Greek texts, the word that's translated with race in that translation appears in the lexicon with the language of race as part of its definition. And that really sort of points to the degree to which pseudoscientific understandings of race as being a genetic reality related to ancestry are widespread and are predominant in mainstream understandings of human difference. And so the white nationalists don't have to come up with a new translation of Plato that suits their purposes. They can just turn to existing translations that sort of import the language of race into their translations, and they can point to them and say Plato was worried about race mixing and thought that the best part of the victory in the Persian War was that it preserved the racial purity of ancient Greece. And so, the white nationalists argue, we should be worried about immigration and intermarriage between immigrants and white Americans or white Europeans, because those are a kind of modern Persian invasion that risks undermining the racial purity of our nation. The appeal to Plato as a source of prestige and legitimacy and kind of time-honored truth is one of the ways they make this argument.
Well, on some level, should we be completely surprised that Greco-Roman antiquity provides fertile ground for our contemporary far right with their fixation on hierarchy, given that these were enslaving societies and societies in which women were seen as inferior?
I don't think we should be surprised at all. And in a way, I would hope once someone works through my book and sees all the examples of ways that ancient Greece and Rome does provide historical models for things that white nationalists advocate and seek, that some people would say, yes, of course, that makes sense now that you point it out. But I think many people that I talk to, it's still surprising to them because the idealization of ancient Greece and Rome, even among people who are aware that it's a slave economy in ancient Greece and Rome, even people who are aware of the exclusions of women from civic life in ancient Athens, for example, I think the idealization of ancient Greece and Rome is so strongly imposed by both our educational system and the classicism of our nation that there's a great tendency to say, oh, ancient slavery, that's a feature of the time. Exclusion of women from civic rights, that's a feature of the time. Let's look at all these other amazing things they did. And really, those things are all bound up together, and the white nationalists know that. They look at ancient Athens, where, as you say, it's a slave economy, women are excluded from civic rights. They look at ancient Athens where, in addition to those aspects, there was a special tax levied on any foreigner who wanted to live in Athens, and a further tax levied on foreigners who wanted to do business in Athens. Those foreigners were subject to special legal scrutiny, surveillance by citizens, and subject to special legal penalties if they tried to access any civic rights. This is ancient Athens, considered the birthplace of democracy in the popular imagination. And white nationalists can look at that and say, those exclusions, those hierarchies, Athens proves that those are completely compatible with democratic institutions, that the birthplace of democracy had them, and so should we if we want to have a strong democracy on the model of this birthplace of democracy. So I agree with you. It's not surprising when you look at all the violence and oppression in the ancient world, but it's surprising in relation to the idealization of Greco-Roman antiquity that's, I think, still widespread in our society.
Well, let's shift more to the present. Can you describe briefly the origins of the new right, particularly the intellectual far right? You were describing how after World War II, fascist ideas were discredited, and so various ideas had to dress themselves up in a certain kind of garb, and that the ideas of ancient Greece and Rome and the iconography and imagery served a purpose. And then, of course, bring it more to our moment, these ideas in the United States have been used to undergird assumptions about the place of especially white men in this society and the idea of a fall from a past golden age, you know, hence the need to make America great again. That, for a lot of people, all seems, for lack of a better term, very crude. You know, we associate it with figures like Donald Trump, who is anything but an intellectual. But you're also saying we actually need to take these ideas seriously if we're interested in challenging them. And so I wanted to ask you, how do you see the more fleshed out, complex intellectual trajectory of these ideas starting after World War II and leading up to now?
So earlier in this conversation, I referred to this development of a new way of promoting fascist ideas in relation to the criminalization and legal bans placed on traditional fascist organizing in Europe following the Second World War. And that took the form of a ideological movement, of a philosophical movement, commonly called the New Right. It started in France and spread especially to Germany and Austria. Now there are versions of it in Italy too, even in Britain. And that movement looked very different from the sort of brown shirts marching in the street that you saw in the period of fascist flourishing before the Second World War. This was a movement of ideas. This was an intellectual movement. Not that there was no intellectualism before it, but this was a primarily intellectual movement. In fact, Alain de Benoist and Dominique Venner and some of these French thinkers who were really at the beginning of it, they thought of themselves as a think tank, developing a new way of talking about and a new way of promoting white nationalist ideas in the wake of the Second World War. And the acronym that de Benoist chose for their think tank, GRECE, G-R-E-C-E, this is an acronym that in French stands for the Research and Study Group for European Civilization. But that acronym shows the significance of the ancient Greco-Roman world for them. He chose an acronym that invokes ancient Greece and Rome. So right from the beginning of this new right, thinking about ancient Greece and Rome were central, and especially Greece, were central to their ideological program. It took a while for those ideas to start to take root, right? You think about contemporary white nationalist activism, you think about people at the January 6th Capitol riot in 2021, there were people with Spartan-style military helmets on their heads attacking the U.S. Capitol, waving flags with ancient Greek slogans on them. One demonstrator had a banner that said, "Cross the Rubicon, Donald Trump," referring to Julius Caesar marching his army on Rome. I think you can look at those people and say they don't know anything about history. They just saw the movie 300 and put on a Spartan helmet and go try to overthrow the government. But go back to the time of de Benoist and Venner and these European thinkers who knew a lot about the ancient world, writing about the ancient world. Those ideas start to get picked up in other countries. They start making their way into the United States in especially the 2000s and 2010. The internet and the global communication hastens that process. You can never demonstrate the links between these ideas and real world violence. It's very hard to demonstrate the links between ideas and real world violence. But I have to believe that all of this intellectual work using the ancient world to justify white nationalist politics can be traced through a process that we can't know all the steps, but somewhere down the line, these ideas keep getting picked up, repackaged, repurposed. Somewhere down the line, a person who is feeling the pull to go to the Capitol riot and attack the U.S. Capitol, if they're able to think of themselves as a Spartan warrior taking a heroic last stand to save their civilization from domination by what they see as a sinister foreign power in the form, say, of President Biden or the Democrats or the left, as the contemporary movement is always vilifying progressive politicians as, if they're able to see themselves as noble warriors making a heroic last stand, that makes it easier to show up at the rally and engage in violence. I see a link that, as I say, can't be traced between all this writing about the Spartan warriors, for example, describing them as models for white heroism. These are in the publications I studied for my book. The Battle of Thermopylae as the first great battle to save the West and so on. All this idealization of the Spartan warrior kind of trickles down, I think, finds its way being repackaged, restated into these activist communities who then use those ideas or take inspiration from those ideas to engage in real world violence and white nationalist activism. One good example where you can really see the scale of it is the conspiracy theory known as the Great Replacement, which is this idea that it's not always an anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, but very often it states or implies that there's a kind of shadowy group of Jews who are promoting this. But it's a conspiracy theory that claims that world governments, possibly shadowy cabal of Jews, are trying to bring about the extermination of the white race by promoting immigration, the replacement of white majorities with non-white immigration. That's a Great Replacement conspiracy theory, which, thanks to it being picked up by Tucker Carlson when he had his show on Fox News, became so well known and such a prominent conspiracy theory that at one point something like 2/3 of Republicans accepted some version of this conspiracy theory, and something like 1/3 of all Americans. I saw a study that the number one predictor of participation in the Capitol riot in 2021 was belief in the Great Replacement conspiracy theory. So this is a very widespread idea, which is now completely in the political mainstream. It has its origins in a surprising place, in the work of a French intellectual, Renaud Camus, who wrote a book called Le Grand Replacement, The Great Replacement. He came up, that's his phrase. He wrote a book about that, about really Islamic and African immigration to France. And Camus is a very learned man. He's a very good writer. Before he wrote this book, he was best known actually as a figure of some importance in the gay literary scene in France. And he wrote this book called Le Grand Replacement. And in the French version of that book, he begins with a discussion of a dialogue of Plato, the Cratylus, not so much because that book makes the argument he's making in his treatise, but because in the Cratylus, Plato has two characters, one Cratylus who says that words have a true and natural meaning that is inseparable from the words, and a different character, Hermogenes, says that no, the meanings of words are just conventional and subject to change. There's nothing natural about what words mean. And so Camus is using this debate, which is unresolved in the Platonic dialogue, to ask, is Frenchness a word with a natural, unchangeable meaning, like Cratylus says, or is it just a conventional, arbitrary meaning, like Hermogenes would say? And Camus is saying that the, as he would put it, the globalists who seek to exterminate the white race, they treat Frenchness like Hermogenes does, that just by giving you citizenship, by giving you a set of papers, you can have Frenchness. Whereas he says, no, Frenchness is something natural, it's something real, unchangeable. He's basically saying it's something racial, but he's arguing that in this frame of this prestigious Platonic dialogue. It's a little humorous to me that in the English translation of his book, the discussion of Platonic dialogue is moved to the end of the book. It's very prominent in the French edition, and it's kind of in a later section in the English translation. Maybe he thought that it wouldn't get as much traction in the U.S. as it did in France as a compelling idea. But be that as it may, the idea of the Great Replacement has become very compelling. It's a predictor, as I said, of participation in the Capitol riot, and it is directly associated with several acts of racist terrorism. The shooter in Christchurch, New Zealand, cited the Great Replacement in his manifesto, and so did several other mass murderers in the United States.
What role does Greco-Roman antiquity, particularly ancient Rome, play for white nationalists, far-right people in the United States, in their obsession with the decline of society, you know, a past golden age that needs to be restored?
If ancient Greece is held up as the model for everything we should be doing, ancient Rome is usually invoked in white nationalist circles as a warning for the impending catastrophe if white nationalist ideas are not adopted. Rome is held up as an example of a society that went too far in accepting outsiders, in incorporating outsiders into its institutions and its society. You even find white nationalists arguing against Roman mass enslavement because they see the importation of enslaved people to Italy and Rome as the source of race mixing once those enslaved people were freed, and as we know from history, intermarried with freeborn Romans. They see that as a source of racial decline for the Romans. So the Roman Empire is seen as a society that became racially degenerate, that became morally degenerate, and that was ultimately destroyed by violent invaders, quote-unquote barbarians, who had retained a sort of barbarian vigor or racial vigor that made it easy for them to conquer the degenerate Romans. And they look at the United States, very diverse cosmopolitan society, and they look at Europe, increasingly a diverse cosmopolitan society, and they say, these places are going the way of Rome. And they find, just as with ancient Greece, they find a lot of basis for their claims in ancient sources. The idea of the violent barbarian who poses a threat to the stability of your civilization is articulated very strongly in ancient Roman historical writing. It's articulated by the men who had the most to lose from a demographic change of the makeup of the Roman Empire. And it was articulated in a time when the Romans had ceased to successfully integrate outsiders into their society, had begun marginalizing and vilifying outsiders to a greater degree than they historically had. So I don't want to say there was no violence from outsiders, but the Roman sources paint that as the outsiders are violent and they need to be kept out. But I think it's more productive to see that as their own fear of political change driving their description of that, and also kind of structural causes within the Roman Empire, which increase the likelihood of violence in these encounters with outsiders who had before been incorporated. This is more at the period of the end of the Republic, but there are a lot of ancient Roman sources that talk about moral decline. Who you think about some of the transphobic rhetoric on the from the right these days, and even from the left, frankly. Sallust, the Roman historian Sallust, has a line that says that one of the reasons Rome of his time is degenerate and in decline is because there are men playing the woman. That's very well suited to transphobic rhetoric to say that the Roman historian Sallust attributed civilizational decline to that idea. But Sallust, of course, has a political axe to grind. He's a partisan of Julius Caesar. He is interested in representing the contemporary Roman world as one that is on the brink of collapse, is hopelessly degenerate, and in need of authoritarian leadership to right the ship. And when you see the ancient sources in that light, when you recognize the political biases of those who are writing them, you can recognize that not only are they very suitable for interpretation by white nationalists and authoritarian politicians, but they actually diagnose what's going on in our society. All this vilification of trans people, all this vilification of immigrants is part of the fascist playbook for justifying authoritarian rule.
I wanted to ask you about architecture. Trump famously in his first term announced that architecture must be classical. It must be inspired by Greco-Roman antiquity, or at least our contemporary notion of what that is, which of course is also what Hitler and Mussolini valorized. How should we understand Trump's architectural aesthetic?
It's a great question because, as you alluded to earlier, he's not someone known for his good taste, right? And he's not someone known for his sort of interest in history or sophisticated aesthetic movements or anything like that. So there's something surprising about his continued return to classical architecture, both in the leaked executive order in his first presidency. He reissued that executive order in the new term as president. On the campaign trail, he referred to it. I think he told CPAC something like, if I'm elected, we will get rid of bad and ugly buildings and return to the magnificent classical style of Western civilization. So this has been something he really is committed to and returns to. And you're right. People see this as a sign of his authoritarian tendencies because it's the same aesthetic style that was embraced by Hitler and Mussolini and other, you know, notorious dictators. They see it as a dog whistle to his white nationalist supporters. And they see it as a sort of typical architectural move from the authoritarian playbook. All that is true, but what I want to add to that from my point of view is that he's making that argument in a country where classical architecture is a highly admired architectural form that many people actually do think should be the dominant architectural form for federal buildings. If you read the text of his new executive order, it begins with a little history of classical architecture in the United States, and it refers to the founders, so-called, and it says they wanted America's public buildings to inspire the American people and encourage civic virtue. And they modeled the most important buildings in Washington, D.C. on the classical architecture of ancient Athens and Rome, and they sought to use that architecture to visually connect our contemporary republic with their antecedents of democracy in classical antiquity. Now, you can read that in the executive order and think, I think it'd be a reasonable reaction to say, okay, this is like right-wing doublespeak. Can you believe the absurdity of a administration this authoritarian talking about civic virtue and antecedents of democracy? But actually, that's a completely normal way of talking about classical architecture in this country, which you alluded to maybe way back in the beginning of our conversation, that that architectural style is thought to represent the democratic ideals of our country. We learn that in school. We see it in media. We see it in our own communities where libraries, banks, museums, other governmental buildings have that architectural style. So all of us are on some level conditioned to associate that with the ideals that the executive order is promoting. And so when Trump cites the study of the National Civic Arts Society that found that 72% of Americans across all political, racial, gender, and socioeconomic lines prefer traditional architecture, I don't think that's just right-wing propaganda. I think that's true. I think actually most Americans do prefer it because they've been taught to prefer it by the prominence of that architecture in our society. And so I think if we talk about Trump's fascination with classical architecture only in terms of the link with Hitler and Mussolini and notorious dictators, we're kind of missing what I think is really significant about the way he's using it, which is that he is invoking, as part of his authoritarian program, something that is widely admired and respected by many Americans. And it sort of epitomizes what I'm talking about all through this conversation, the way that the prestige of Greco-Roman antiquity is used to make authoritarian and white nationalist ideas seem respectable, desirable, inevitable, natural. Because actually, I think that this architecture, it isn't just about democratic ideals. It's also, in its original purpose, a move to invent a connection between the new nation and European imperial capitals. It's part of the replacement of indigenous histories and cultural styles in North America with a European version or with a European civilization. And so the sanitization of it, the idealization of it as a symbol of civic virtue is kind of erasing or distracting away from or papering over this very violent imperialist history that that architecture also symbolizes. And that's why it's so useful to Trump, because he thinks those are good things. He wants America to be more imperial, to be more violent, to be more hierarchical. And that's what that architecture is historically associated with, all the way back to ancient Rome when it was used to, you know, mark the presence of the Roman Empire in those places.
Well, then that leads me to my last question, which is, given what you've just said, the multiple uses of the Greco-Roman past of antiquity, how should we in this society now, given that history of imperialism, of different forms of political rule dressing itself up in the garb of antiquity, how should we now regard that past? Should we reject its legacy wholesale?
No, definitely not. I think what I'm calling for is a greater consciousness of the association of Greco-Roman antiquity with prestige. There was a book that came out a few years ago called Banal Nationalism, which was about all the ways, especially in the United States, that the idealization of the American nation is just hammered into us in, as the author says, banal ways. The hanging of flags everywhere, the flag on the wall in the schoolroom, the Pledge of Allegiance at the beginning of the school day, the national anthem being sung at the baseball game, and so on and so forth. And it's so omnipresent that you, especially if you grew up with it, you're not even aware of all the ways you're being reminded every day to idealize the nation state and ignore the violence that created it and the hierarchies and oppression that it still authorizes and maintains. And I think there's something parallel with classicism, with these invocations of the ancient Greek and Roman worlds that are, I think, almost as omnipresent in our society, if you take the big picture, both in terms of architecture, our media landscape, and so on. References to ancient Greece and Rome are omnipresent in our society. And so I think a first step for many people is to defamiliarize that, to notice when that's happening, to notice all the ways that the ancient world, whether it's the Latin language or Greek mythology or Greek history or Roman history, are invoked as models, as sources of prestige, as sources of legitimacy. Whether it's for white nationalist politics or not, just this, I just become attuned to the way the ancient world is used as a source of prestige. And once you notice that, I think it's very hard not to realize how ideological, how political all engagements with the ancient world are. And from there, I think, right, we don't throw out this history, but we start to regard it in a way that doesn't fall for the idealization of it, that doesn't allow it to be sanitized, that holds at the same time some of the things from the ancient world that maybe are worth admiring or imitating or at least taking seriously and considering, that holds those at the same time as all the violence and oppression that the ancient world contained and has authorized through time in the way it's been used by many of the historians, for example, that Martin Bernal was writing about. We hold those things together. That might be a very basic thing to say. Oh, we need to be more critical. We need to have a sort of more balanced view of history. But it's actually when a period of history is so idealized, is so connected to dominant power, is so potent a form of rhetorical power, I think it's actually a radical act just to take a balanced view of it. So once the dominant view in our society is this balanced critical view of Greco-Roman antiquity, then we can have a new conversation about, yeah, what is the status of this history? How should we approach it? But right now, I think we're still in a stage of trying to shake and destabilize this idealization and take this more critical view of that history.
Curtis Dozier, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks so much for the conversation. I really enjoyed it.
Curtis Dozier is Associate Professor of Greek and Roman Studies at Vassar College. We've been discussing The White Pedestal, How White Nationalists Use Ancient Greece and Rome to Justify Hate. He's the director of the website Pharos, Doing Justice to the Classics, which documents how hate groups appropriate Greco-Roman antiquity. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time.